Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
From Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
And from Granite State College, offering diverse bachelor's and graduate business degree programs online. Designed to help working adults advance. Granite State College, where quality matters. More information and registration at granite.edu.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Saving the biggest drama for the final act, the U.S. Supreme Court closed out its term yesterday with a decision on President Trump's travel ban. A majority of justices ruled to allow a limited version of the ban to go into effect, with broader consideration put off until fall. Today in The Exchange, we look at the legal arguments in this case, both by the high court and the lower court decisions rejected by the high court. Later in the hour, we'll cover other key rulings this term, including one that concerned the use of offensive speech in a trademark name, and another on whether a church-based daycare center could use public funds to repave a playground. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our guests are Jennifer Sargent, Associate Professor of Writing and Rhetoric at Dartmouth College, a former law professor, district court judge, and public defender. Also with us, John Graby, a professor at UNH Law. And both of you, welcome. And John, to you first. President Trump's travel ban. We're going to have to walk through this piece by piece, yeah. John. The words partial and limited are being used a lot to describe this ruling. What's partial or limited about it?
Well, one of the things that that sometimes gets lost in the discussion about this is that the courts have not yet ruled on the merits with respect to the travel ban.
This, is it constitutional or not?
Yeah. What they've done is put the parties who have challenged the travel ban went in and sought a preliminary injunction to prevent them from going into effect. Lower courts granted preliminary injunctions to keep the travel bans from going into effect. And what the Supreme Court did yesterday is to partially affirm those preliminary injunctions, but partially to reverse. The injunctions completely banned the so-called travel ban from going into effect. And the travel ban has two components. 90-day review before foreign nationals from six countries would be permitted in the country, and then 120-day review before refugees.
So it says it doesn't say you can't come in. It says there's a 90-day or 120-day pause on your entrance based on your status.
That's right, during which the executive branch is going to take a look at its admission procedures and the threats posed by admissions from these countries. So what the Supreme Court did yesterday is to basically say we're going to keep the essence of the injunctions below insofar as they relate to people who already have connections to this country. So students or relatives of families from these six nations and also refugees, they are still going to be permitted to come to the country. But for people who do not have close connections to the country already, the president's order is going to be allowed to go into effect.
So those with, and I'm quoting here, with a credible claim of a bona fide relationship with a person or entity in the U.S. So, you know, you are scheduled to attend, you know, school in the United States as a college student. You've got family. You have a job assignment with a company in Silicon Valley. I mean, those folks are allowed to come in under the regular rules that are in place.
Right. And if you remember, that's what, you know, all the chaos that broke out when the travel ban was first announced was that, you know, people who already held visas, people who were coming to go to school or to teach for a semester, suddenly their status was thrown into question. Those, that group of individuals is still going to be able to come in the interim. It's just that new visas are not going to be handed out or refugee status is not going to be granted to people who don't already have connections.
That sounds like a pretty big group, Jennifer. Those with a credible claim of a bona fide relationship with person or entity. I mean, entity is a, you know, could be a lot of institutions.
It could be. And that was actually one of the concerns of one of the groups, Alito, Gorsuch, and Thomas, who believed that this partial foray into the preliminary injunctions was actually going to create a lot of confusion and, frankly, a lot of litigation that was going to happen because of it. But the Supreme Court was surprisingly explicit in what they considered bona fide. They did give examples in the opinion. They managed to say that there were certain types of relationships specifically that qualified as bona fide relationships. And therefore, they did to some extent give some guidance. And they don't always do that. So it was a relatively explicit opinion for the Supreme Court.
Were you surprised, Jennifer, by this sort of, I don't want to call it splitting hairs, but, you know, the way they kind of tried to find a middle ground on this?
I wasn't surprised at all, actually, because what we have here is a preliminary injunction. And what the court is being asked to do here is not to grant one, but to stay one. And they mention that much in the opinion. So if they're staying a preliminary injunction, there's actually a process by which they don't reach the merits. They just have to decide what to do with the injunction, stop, go, remain the same until they get to the merits. And in that respect, what they have to do is an exercise of equities. They have to examine what would be equitable in this situation to place the injunction in sort of a holding pattern until they reach the merits. So the fact that they came up with an exercise of equitable discretion where they were considering, okay, how do we make this equitable for those people who are going to be in that flux that John was talking about, in that uncertain situation, what serves immediately the absolute purpose that we can see the Trump administration is trying to address? And how can we narrow it or make it fair so that until we decide whether or not the travel ban is constitutional, we can make sure that the right people are protected and the right people are not infringed upon.
So, again, looking at this group and that attempt to reach some sort of equity, as Jennifer describes, John, so you look at it, you think, okay, you've got family or you're a student, you know, but there seems like there could be some other gray areas. What if I'm from one of these six countries and I have a prepaid tour of the Grand Canyon? So, I mean, that tour is an entity, but it's not like a job or going to school. So, I mean, is this opening the door for some more lawsuits?
Oh, there's absolutely going to be some judgment calls that are going to have to be made. They're going to be made by lower level officials within the executive branch. It's unlikely that that is going to lead to litigation that's going to be able to run up the chain. I mean, it takes a while to decide a lawsuit. You know, so there may be some fights over the summer, but the Supreme Court has said they're going to put this on the docket then for, a full review in October. By then, the executive branch will presumably have completed the review that it says that it's going to undertake. There's actually a fairly significant chance that the court never reaches the merits of this decision. The whole thing might become moot because the administration may conduct its review and say, okay, we're now convinced that our procedures are fine and that we can resume business as usual. Or the administration may take an entirely different position, in which case a new lawsuit would have to arise if they change, you know, they change the policy in some way. This is a temporary policy.
So the rationale is by the Trump administration is we need this pause. Let us have this pause so that we can review our entry procedures to make sure they are safe. You're saying if after 90 days, John, they review them and they say, OK, we're all set, then this second review by the Supreme Court in October will be moot.
It'll be moot. That's right.
I still had a hard time understanding this morning, Jennifer, why the Supreme Court didn't, you know, bite off the whole kahuna. I mean, why do they do these little things and say, we'll do the big thing in the fall?
Well, because they weren't ready. Frankly, it is going to take a lot of time and effort to suss out all of these constitutional issues. And right now, there are preliminary injunctions in place. It's the injunctions that they're examining at the moment and not the merits decision, not the actual travel ban. So procedurally, the court did exactly what they needed to do.
1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Today in Exchange, what you need to know about what the U.S. Supreme Court did this term. And we're starting off talking about the ruling on President Trump's travel ban. Later on, we'll talk about some really interesting cases concerning the First Amendment and the practice of gerrymandering. Join us with your questions and comments. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, Jennifer, you piqued my interest. You said, okay, later on, they say they'll look at the constitutional issues of this travel ban. What are those constitutional issues?
Well, the constitutional issues reach to the First Amendment. They reach to religion and whether or not there is a violation of the Establishment Clause, whether there's a violation of the Free Exercise Clause. Is the Trump administration preferencing certain religions over other religions? Is it actively prohibiting the Muslim religion from exercising its rights in the same way other religions do in the United States? It's a major First Amendment question.
The Establishment Clause, just remind us real quick, John.
The Establishment Clause of the First Amendment says that the government cannot act so as to establish a religion. And it's been read to mean that it cannot prefer one religious group to another.
So the constitutional case that Jennifer is mentioning is people could say, look, this violates or has concerns around the Establishment Clause because it seems to discriminate against one religion over
others. Yeah, I mean, it's actually on the face of the policy, there is no mention made of religion. The problem is that the president campaigned on a promise to ban Muslims from entering the country, and lower courts found that although the executive orders were not framed in religious terms, they were motivated by an animus towards a particular religion, Islam. And so they found that there was a likelihood of success that the plaintiffs would prove that the executive orders, the travel bans, were unconstitutional. They violated the Establishment Clause.
That's what the lower court said. And there were a bunch of lower court cases surrounding this.
That's right. Lawsuits were filed all around the country, and a judge in Hawaii found that the executive orders were likely unconstitutional, and the Ninth Circuit upheld that ruling. And a judge in Virginia also found that the executive orders were likely unconstitutional, and the Fourth Circuit upheld that ruling.
Jennifer, why do you think the high court viewed this differently from all those other lower courts?
Well, the high court hasn't reached it yet, so we don't know how they've viewed it. There's very little, I think, to be gained in reading the tea leaves on this one based on what they've done with the preliminary injunction, because we don't have any indication from the Supreme Court yet about whether the president's intent in terms of an executive order matters at all in a constitutional interpretation. So while the lower courts focused very, very carefully and very, very, very significantly on President Trump's intent, the bottom line is that we don't know what the Supreme Court is going to do with President Trump's intent and President Trump's campaign statements, let alone, you know, his Twitter statements. So right now, all we have is how the high court, has reacted to that preliminary injunction.
Well, for your average person, it's a lot to untangle the preliminary aspect, the court ruling on this piece of it, but holding off until fall, and maybe that that fall review will never come because, as John said, it might be moot. Here's Tom in Exeter. He says the president has been in office for over 5 months now. The bans are 90 and 120 days long. Shouldn't they have completed their review by now? Why are they waiting for the ban to be in place before starting the review? Tom, it's a great question. John?
Well, the administration interpreted the preliminary injunction as precluding them from going ahead with the review that they proposed to undertake.
And all the court activity, you mean?
Yes, that's right. So in the lower courts, when the lower courts issued injunctions, the Trump administration understood those injunctions to prevent them from reviewing the procedures in the way that they announced they were going to do. And so now it's clear, the Supreme Court made it clear in its order yesterday, go ahead and do your review, you know, do your vetting and make your decision about what your policy is going to be.
So they were basically waiting for the courts to say, yeah, go ahead and do this.
That's right.
Well, Tom, thank you for the question. And again today in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions about some of the legal thoughts behind some of the biggest U.S. Supreme Court cases this term. We're looking right now at President Trump's travel ban, but there's a lot of other cases to look at as well. We welcome your comments, 1-800-892-6477, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So, John, Jennifer said something interesting, that it's important not to look too much at the tea leaves. What do you think? Are there any tea leaves worth looking at in
this? Well, what's a little bit interesting to me is that Justice Kennedy and Chief Justice Roberts were clearly in the majority yesterday. And you know, when you sort of back up and you realize what the lower courts found, it was really quite extraordinary. Again, these executive orders were orders pertaining to national security issues. And that's something that the court usually really defers to the president on. And so it was really extraordinary for these lower courts to find that the reasons stated in the orders were not the real reasons for them. That's very, very unusual. And to make a finding, essentially, that the president, or that it looks very much like the president, is being disingenuous. I mean, that was the essence of the lower court rulings. That's a remarkable thing. And for conservative justices such as Roberts and Kennedy to at least for now sign off on that is, I suggest, you know, somewhat significant. Now, though, it's absolutely true that their votes don't bind them to any position on the merits. And so it could be very, very different come the fall if the Supreme Court does indeed reach the merits of this case. But this has been an extraordinary episode. It really has.
Well, and legal watchers love to look at, Jennifer, you know, who voted yes, who voted no, what did they say, which is often very interesting. This does get us to the makeup of the new court. New Justice Neil Gorsuch, who joined in April. How did he vote, Jennifer, on this travel ban?
Well, Neil Gorsuch wanted the travel ban, the preliminary injunction, to just simply be lifted entirely and the Trump administration's order to go into full force.
Full force.
Full force.
None of these accepted categories.
Exactly. Then. Even on a preliminary injunction basis, because he believed, I think the concern was more that it was going to create confusion and problems if there was a halfway point where there was still some room for interpretation, bona fide relationship, what kind of tie makes it, what kind of tie to the country makes it a relationship. And so I think that his concern preliminarily was that of confusion. Although I do think there might be something in there that also suggests that presidential power and the president's authority to write an executive order and have the executive order in place is something that is the president's purview and not the purview of the courts to get into.
That's the broader philosophy that we're seeing, right, Jennifer, of these justices, how much they think that the president's executive authority should be extended, questioned, challenged, and so forth.
That's right. And Neil Gorsuch has never been anything except as advertised in terms of what his jurisprudence has been. He's a strict constructionist, very textualist at times, and really does believe in a hardcore separation of powers. So for Justice Gorsuch, it's not a surprise that he took that position at all.
So a constructionalist means what?
A strict constructionist, somebody who really places a lot of emphasis on what the Constitution says and means in the context of when it was written and how it was written, and that's about it. A textualist goes a little further in decontextualizing the language and says more like the dictionary definitions are what are important, but they're extremely related and both really say the Constitution says what it means and it's not to be interpreted outside of the four corners of the document.
All right, more looking at this year's U.S. Supreme Court term, some of the key cases. We'll take your comments and questions as well, 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
I was wondering.
I'm curious to know more about.
My question is, what is a filibuster?
How does the Electoral College work?
What is required for declaring war?
A majority whip.
Congressional caucuses.
You've got questions? We've got answers. Civics 101, the shame-free podcast refresher course on how our democracy works. There is no such thing as a stupid question. So ask away and subscribe to Civics 101 on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your podcasts.
Thank you so much. Keep up the excellent work.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, two legal analysts join us on what you need to know about what the U.S. Supreme Court did this term, including the case we're looking at now concerning President Trump's travel ban. In just a few minutes, we'll turn to some real interesting cases concerning the First Amendment and also the practice of gerrymandering. Join us with your questions and comments about some of the legal issues tied up in these cases, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Jennifer Sargent, John Graby, back to our listeners. Becky's in Concord. Hi, Becky. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. My question is how this Supreme Court ruling is going to affect the refugee program. And I understand that refugees they don't have jobs officially when they first come here, but they do have connections with the resettlement agencies. Do those constitute a bona fide relationship, and will they be able to still come in? And I'll take my your answer off the air.
Becky, thanks so much for the call. And John, you mentioned this earlier, these classes of people that are allowed to come in.
Yeah, I mean, again, refugees with these bona fide connections are going to be permitted to come. In the opinion yesterday, in the per curiam opinion, the Supreme Court made clear that a mere connection with an immigrant or refugee organization is not going to be enough. It's going to require something more than that. The fact of the matter is, I just heard on the radio yesterday, that far fewer refugees have come into the country since President Trump assumed office. There's been a dramatic drop, and I would expect that to continue. We'll see what happens after the review, after the 120-day review.
But refugees are chosen, vetted, selected by the State Department, so that sounds like a pretty bona fide, to use the words that the court keeps using, institution.
Well, that I would think so, yes. Yeah. But I think there's going to be hard judgments to be made, again, by executive branch officials. And there's going to be judgments made based on, you know, where people are in the process and how far they've proceeded along the path.
Jennifer?
The court specifically says that for individuals, a bona fide relationship is a close familial relationship. A foreign national, for instance, who wishes to enter the United States to live with or visit a family member has such a relationship. And as for entities, to your question before, the relationship must be formal, documented, and formed in the ordinary course rather than for the purpose of evading the executive order. For instance, the students designated from the designated countries who have been admitted to the University of Hawaii have such a relationship with the American entity of the university. So too would a worker who has accepted an offer of employment from an American company or a lecturer invited to address an American audience, not someone who enters into a relationship simply to avoid a particular section of the executive order. So the Supreme Court specifically singles out, for example, a nonprofit group devoted to immigration issues may not contact foreign nationals from the designated countries, add them to a client list, and then secure their entry by claiming injury from their exclusion.
So sort of seeking an attractive plaintiff.
Exactly, and looking for immigrants to bring to the country. So I think with the immigration issue, it is going to be quite different than it's going to be for the regular individual who seeks to visit their family member or attend school or a job.
But that's immigrants. Refugees are a different category.
They're
part of a State Department
program. And refugees, though, are often categorized along the lines. They're thought of in the context of immigrants rather than in the context of a visitor with an already established tie. So I think the court may reconcile the two more closely.
Well, Becky, thanks for the call. And you can join us to 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR. Exchange. Jennifer, go ahead.
I'm sorry to say, but I just looked down at the opinion, and the court does also specifically say when it comes to refugees who lack any such connection to the United States, for the reasons we've set out, the balance tips in favor of the government's compelling need to provide for national security, which is going to be the ultimate test.
You mentioned earlier that this case also shows us how the new justice, Neil Gorsuch, who joined in April, how he thinks. You said he's a big believer in the separation of powers and that the president should have his authority, along with the courts having theirs and Congress having its. What else have we learned about Justice Gorsuch since he's been on just in the last 2 months?
Justice Gorsuch hasn't given us much, but he's definitely telegraphed his ideology. There was an early order list a couple of months ago whereby the Supreme Court simply lists the cases that it grants certiorari, which means takes for decision, or doesn't take for decision. And in one of those early order lists, the order simply said the court doesn't accept this particular case, but it was noted that both Justice Thomas and Justice Gorsuch would have accepted certiorari. For an order list, that's a very unusual thing. Order lists usually don't do anything except say either they've accepted it or they've denied it. So for the order list to even insinuate explicitly that Gorsuch would have wanted that case on the docket, that was a really telling statement. And it came in a very unusual place and very early on. Now we've had a couple. We've had one, I believe, majority opinion authored by Justice Gorsuch that was not particularly surprising. But we got a great taste of what he thinks about at least strict constitutional procedure yesterday in a case that's not getting a lot of play but is interesting. It's actually the case of Pavan versus Smith, and it was decided and released yesterday, the last day of the court. And what had happened in that case is there was in Arkansas there was a gay couple, and they had a child together by artificial insemination, to women who are married. And in that case, Arkansas refused to place both of their names as parents on the birth certificate because it has a biological paradigm for putting parents on the birth certificate. So in this case, the opinion was a summary reversal, which simply means the court grants the writ of certiorari, vacates the underlying decision of Arkansas to refuse to put the names of the parents on the birth certificate.
So wait, you're going to have to unravel that for me a little bit. So did the high court say, Arkansas, you can't do this? Or
yes.
Did it say, sorry, parents, you can't have
it
this?
It did. It said, Arkansas, you can't do this. And you have to put the names of the married homosexual couple, both of them listed as parents, even though one of them isn't the biological parent of the child.
Well, that's a big deal. I'm surprised that that hasn't gotten more attention. So how did Neil Gorsuch vote in this instance?
Well, interestingly, what he did was he dissented, but he dissented on procedural grounds because what he said was, you know, a summary reversal, which is what the court did, is usually reserved for cases where the law is settled and stable, the facts aren't in dispute, and the decision below is clearly an error. And he took issue with the fact that this was a simple case. In fact, he said that his initial sort of foray into this constitutional analysis showed that there was really in Arkansas no constitutional provision that prohibited Arkansas from creating this biological paradigm when it came to listing parents on birth certificates.
Again, the number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We're looking at some of the biggest cases that came down from the Supreme Court this term, including, as we're hearing, several from just yesterday, the last day of the term. And we'd love your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Emails are welcome, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. So while we're talking about, you know, sort of personalities on the court, and it is interesting, Jennifer, to hear how this new justice, sort of his worldview and how he may approach cases in the future, there's been some chatter, John Graby, that Justice Anthony Kennedy might retire, the man in the middle, as they call him.
There were a lot of rumors that Justice Kennedy might retire, but he didn't do so.
So yesterday would have been the day
probably
for him to do it?
I mean, he could do it any time, certainly, but it is customary for justices to announce their retirement on the last day of the term. The first time I ever visited the Supreme Court was the last day of the term in 1987, when the vacancy surprisingly sprang into being that led to Anthony Kennedy being appointed to the court.
Oh, really?
And it was
wow.
Like a scene from a 1940s movie. It was back then, it was pre-internet and everything, and the whole press corps got up and ran out in the hallway, you know, clearly, you know, needing to phone in this news. But when Justice Lewis Powell decided to retire, and nobody saw it coming. So the fact that he did not announce his retirement yesterday suggests to me that he does not intend to retire, that he certainly intends to stay on for next term.
So you look at that portrait of the Supreme Court, and they always get a picture taken, you know, and one of my sons was here yesterday. He said, wow, Mom, they're really old.
Yes, they are.
How old are they, most of them?
Justice Ginsburg is well into her 80s and has fought cancer before. Justice Breyer now is I think around 80. Justice Kennedy is in his 80s. So there are some older justices on the court who are approaching the age where you would think they would be interested in retiring. Lots of speculation. So again, this is tea leaf stuff, but lots of people think that perhaps Justice Kennedy was prepared to retire, but that with everything that's going on right now in the news, including the appointment of a special counsel, which at least theoretically creates the possibility of important decisions arising, you know, or need for important decisions arising pertaining again to presidential power and things like that, that perhaps he saw this as a time where it was important for him to stay on and for the court to remain stable.
Well, I want to turn to a couple other really interesting cases that were decided this term. And John, to you first, a First Amendment free speech case, Mattal versus Tam. Basically, the justices said, you know, trademarks are allowed even if they seem offensive or disparaging. This concerns an Asian boy band, basically.
That's right. A band that just played in Concord, actually, back in April. It was a band called The Slants, is a band called The Slants, and they sought to register their band name as a trademark. And the trademark office rejected it, citing the disparagement clause of the Lanham Act. And the disparagement clause says that offensive or disparaging trademarks will not be recognized by the government. The Slants said, yes, we're an Asian American band. Yes, we understand that Slants has sort of a negative connotation, but we're trying to reclaim that. And so they brought litigation, and the Supreme Court agreed with them and actually struck down this disparagement clause of the Lanham Act and held that the government cannot discriminate on the basis of content and viewpoint in the way that the court believes that the disparagement clause of the Lanham Act dictated. And so this is really a significant First Amendment ruling.
So what jumps out at you from this, Jennifer?
Well, first of all, the courts came right out and said trademarks are not government speech. And in fact, there was a long discussion about not only aren't they government speech, but if they were to be government speech, that the government would essentially be babbling, would be creating all kinds of mixed messages and all kinds of support for certain things that it didn't necessarily support. So the court really didn't buy the argument by the government at all that this was government speech. So that was laid to rest very early in the decision. Also, there was a government contention that the constitutionality of the disparagement clause should be tested under a new governmental program doctrine. In other words, that maybe the disparagement clause wasn't being interpreted correctly by the courts, and that if we only interpreted it correctly, it could still stand. And the Supreme Court said, absolutely not. It's completely, it inhibits free speech. It's not government speech. We are not going to let it stand. The disparagement clause is unconstitutional.
So are there any limits at all now, Jennifer? I mean, can you say anything in a trademark now, no matter how, you know, whether it's inflammatory speech or hate speech? I mean, can you just say anything and say, yeah, this is the name of my company or my band or, you know, my neighborhood group?
Well, John, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm reading the case to say, yeah, that that's fine. It can't be obscene, and it can't be something that would cause panic. But other than that, I think that the court is very concerned and does go on to talk about how even speech that is insightful or hateful can be important speech and can be the product of thought. And therefore, it's not for the Patent and Trademark Office, certainly, to make those decisions.
Wow, it's interesting. Go ahead, John.
Well, the case has a lot of significance for the Washington Redskins. The Washington Redskins had had their trademarks revoked under this same disparagement clause, have been challenging that. The case is presently on hold at the Fourth Circuit, but I don't see how the Redskins lose now in light of this decision. I think that the Redskins are going to be permitted to trademark their name.
So back up just a little bit for people who aren't familiar. So the Washington Redskins, you know, for a long time, people have said, look, this is kind of offensive, Redskin and the mascot and so forth. Let's just also say that several New Hampshire schools, including Manchester Central, have Native Americans as mascots. So people found this offensive. They brought a case, and the Redskins are fighting it in a lower court. But now, is this just basically over? Does everybody go home in that lower court?
Well, everything's under review, but I think under the reasoning of the Supreme Court decision, there'd be absolutely no basis for the Trademark Office to, you know, withhold recognition of the Washington Redskins trademark name.
Now, we've talked a lot in the past, John, about free speech, what's allowed and what isn't. And in the United States, a lot is allowed. The one thing that most people learn from Civics 101 is you can't yell fire in a crowded theater because that creates a danger. Right. Now, given this trademark ruling, you know, could somebody start, start a band or an organization that says, you know, Latinos go home or Nazis are great? I mean, can you do that now and get the trademark approved by the U.S. Trademark Office?
You know, I think the reasoning of the case certainly is going to invite applications for trademarks such as that. One of the things about the law is that it, you know, it never is. It's always about to be. And so, you know, if somebody really pushes the boundaries then there'll be a new case. And then that will provide courts for an opportunity to maybe step in and refine the ruling here. That said, it's becoming very clear, if it wasn't already, that mere offensiveness or hatefulness does not mean that you can regulate speech. And that's also an important aspect of this decision. Supreme Court has really telegraphed strongly that offensive, hateful speech is still speech that's going to be entitled to First Amendment protection. And that has all sorts of ramifications, of course, for, you know, university speech codes and things like that. So this is a really significant case. I think the court has once again weighed in on the side of the First Amendment. This Supreme Court has been very, very strong on the First Amendment over the last few years.
But then we have these cases, and I'm getting back to this yell, you know, you can't yell fire in a crowded room, so to put other people in danger. Jennifer, we have seen cases time and time again where, you know, people who may be unstable or full of rage use this, you know, use this type of language or feed off this type of language, and then they go do something crazy. So that language does incite them or seem to incite them to violence, yelling, you know, creating a stampede in a crowded room, yelling fire, so to speak.
Well, one thing we do know from the Supreme Court is that is not only true, but the court is saying we have to decide these things on a case-by-case basis. We can't just suppress speech with the fear that those things are going to happen.
All right. Lots more to pick up on after a short break. And we'll take your calls, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. More on the U.S. Supreme Court and what it did this term in just a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, key rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court this term, including a couple big decisions that just came down yesterday. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Jennifer Sargent, John Graby, I want to turn to another First Amendment case, this concerning not free speech, but religious freedom. And Jennifer, this is the case of Trinity Lutheran versus Comer, a Missouri preschool and daycare center that wanted to access a Missouri state program that provides rubberized material for school playgrounds. They were told initially no. How come?
Well, they were told initially no because they're part of a church organization. In fact, it's a child organization that's not simply a playground or an after-school program. It's affiliated with the church. It does teach the tenets of Lutheran, of the Lutheran religion. It seeks to make children better Lutherans, and it's affiliated with the church. So the state environmental group that was offering the grant to get this these rubberized tire pieces to make the bottom of the playground softer at the church playground, they were denied. The church was denied the opportunity to even get funding for those pieces of tires simply because they were a church.
What do you think, John, about this case?
Yeah, that's right, because, you know, Missouri is one of a number of states, including New Hampshire, that actually has constitutional provisions that prevent the funding of churches. Money's not supposed to flow to churches under so-called Blaine Amendments that have a really sort of rich and controversial history. So that was the grounds that Missouri relied upon in turning down this application. And so this group said, hey, wait, we're being discriminated against because we are a religious group. Every other group that's seeking this funding is welcome to receive this funding, but the state is saying no to us because we are a religious group. And that violates another provision of the First Amendment, the Free Exercise Clause, which protects the right of individuals to freely exercise their religion. And in a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court agreed with that and said that this does violate the Free Exercise Clause.
So does that mean now that religious-based organizations in Missouri and maybe elsewhere can take public funds? Jennifer?
Well, this was a fascinating case in the sense that it is the first Supreme Court case that says public money can go to a church. Public money can go to a religious institution. Now, that had never been said before.
That's a big deal then.
It's a big deal. But there's a footnote in the opinion, which is footnote number 3. And what's fascinating for legal scholars and should be for everybody else is when you look closely at who concurred with whom and who went, which justices went along with the opinion, the reason I think that there was so much agreement in this decision is because footnote 3 radically reigns in this decision. Now, Chief Justice Roberts wrote this decision. And his footnote is explicit and says, this case is just for this case. The
Missouri.
Facts of this case.
That's it.
That's it. The Gorsuch, Thomas, Alito, they didn't like footnote 3. They thought that it should have gone further. But footnote 3 really circumscribes the case.
Well, and speaking as a member of the general public, you know, you do kind of hope, Jennifer, right? We learn this again in civics when we're kids, that the Supreme Court decides, you know, the law of the land and whether these laws are constitutional. And so we do kind of expect these broad statements from the U.S. Supreme Court, the highest court in the land. It seems like it's their job to help us figure out these big matters of legal policy. So you can understand, it's a little disappointing when they don't make these broad statements.
Yeah, and the way this, the opinion reads, it looks like a very broad statement, which is why it's stunning to get down to footnote 3 and see it read, quote, "This case involves express discrimination based on religious identity with respect to playground resurfacing. We do not address religious uses of funding or any other forms of discrimination."
You know, I got to say, John, your average person, I think, expects more from the high court. You know, don't just decide on playground resurfacing. It sounds like, you know, a city council meeting in some dinky town somewhere.
Well, I think it's going to stand for the proposition that when public money is made available for uses that have nothing to do with religious instruction, like, you know, recovering a playground, that religious groups are going to be able to seek that funding on the same footing as everybody else.
So how about building a new building? So that's expensive, though. That's a lot
depend.
Of public
if,
money.
Yeah, and if that building is a building, though, in which religious instruction is going to take place, then footnote 3, you know, at least theoretically, allows the court in the future to distinguish the case. A lot of speculation that footnote 3 was in there to bring Justice Breyer on board, because Justice Breyer was with the majority here, and that footnote 3 is probably about vouchers. It's probably about the voucher question, because the next question is going to be, look, if it's unconstitutional to deny religious groups funding for playgrounds, why isn't it also unconstitutional to deny the use of vouchers at religious schools? What's the distinction to be drawn? And I think the distinction would have to be that, well, at the schools, there's religious instruction taking place, whereas the playground, it's just a playground. Now, and that's, you know, and the more conservative elements of the court are clearly prepared to go forward and to say that it actually would be unconstitutional to deny vouchers to students who want to use them at religious schools.
So, Jennifer, to hope that footnote 3, if that was Justice Roberts' goal, would only hold this whole decision to this very narrow decision, it sounds like what John's saying is, nah, this is just opening the door to more.
Justice Roberts, I maintain, is, I believe, the savviest writer on the court. There is nothing that he doesn't anticipate. The judges are all, of course, brilliant, but he is a writer with a purpose. He has a very high regard for the Supreme Court's ruling. He said that Supreme Court law develops at a glacial pace. That's a quote. And he really is opening perhaps a door, a crack, and wants to see what might come through that door. But he also needed to get a majority. And I agree. I think Breyer was on the fence and needed to have footnote 3 there. I also think Elena Kagan may have needed that. Interestingly, Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg dissented on the issue of what is religious identity versus what is religious doing. Because the majority of the court in this case said that the church got the money because of the denial of its identity. It's that just because a church identifies as religious doesn't mean that it shouldn't get public funds. Justice Sotomayor said, it's not identity that we're concerned with here, that the Learning Center, the church, the children's church area, serves as a ministry of the church and incorporates daily religion and developmental activities into its program. So it teaches a Christian worldview to the children. And in that respect, it's not an identity issue. It's a doing issue. And therefore, it prefers that religion and doesn't keep it separate.
Okay, so in a way, it's a small deal because of this footnote 3, but in a way, it sounds like it's a huge, huge deal in terms of allowing public funds to go to religiously inspired centers of education, daycare centers.
Of course, it will be precedent. Of course, it will be precedent. So it will become parts of other cases. It's just not clear how yet. I think John's really onto something with the voucher issue.
Okay. Well, we'll expect to hear more about this case and that footnote 3 that you brought to the forefront for us, Jennifer. I am sure, especially in New Hampshire, too, we've got these debates ongoing in this state about public funding private schools. We'll set that aside for now. Again, we invite your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Last issue I really wanted to cover with both of you today, and that's the issue of gerrymandering. We're hearing a lot about this lately. The Supreme Court waded into this issue this term, but didn't take a full dive, if I could put it that way, John Grabe. So just unpack this for us piece by piece. Just remind us, first of all, what gerrymandering is.
Gerrymandering is the drawing of legislative districts with an eye towards achieving some political purpose. So under the Constitution, state legislatures are obliged to draw legislative districts, both for Congress in Washington and for state legislatures. They do it every 10 years after the annual census, because every 10 years, some states gain population and therefore gain a greater entitlement to congressional representation, and other states lose population and therefore may lose a seat or two. And so the state legislature has to redraw congressional districts at that point in time. Gerrymandering is a word, and it goes, and it's been with us forever. It goes back to Elbridge Gerry, actually. It could really should be called gerrymandering. but it's a practice where the political majority at the time redraws those districts to protect incumbents and to protect their own grip on power.
So whoever is in charge at the state house gets to draw the lines for the state house, the state senate, and the U.S. House, and in New Hampshire's case, the Executive Council. That's another set of districts that we have.
That's right. And in 2010 was the last census. Following the two, following that census, Republicans have a grip on state houses around the country. And so the redistricting that took place following the 2010 census has worked to the very strong advantage of Republicans around the country. I read something yesterday that an estimate by Pew that 22 congressional seats, there would be 22 fewer Republican congressional seats but for the gerrymandering that took place after the 2010 census.
And of course, when Democrats are in control, you know, they
they
do the same thing.
They
draw these districts in a way that's extremely favorable, and some of them look like, you know, I don't know, worms or Rorschach tests or roadkill or whatever you want to call it. You know, I have to say, John, I have explained this to a couple friends lately, very smart, very politically savvy folks. And to a person, they've said, oh, my gosh, that sounds so unfair.
It's clearly distortive of Democratic majorities. Most people hear about it and become outraged. The problem has been, what can we do about it? Is there anything to be done about it in the court system? The Supreme Court has hinted that the First Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause, the 14th Amendment, may place some limits on this, but they've never been able to come up with a standard by which a partisan gerrymander, could be held unconstitutional. Now, that may be changing. A court in Wisconsin found that Wisconsin, the Wisconsin legislature, had unconstitutionally gerrymandered following the 2010 census. In 2012, Republicans got 48.6% of the vote, but took 60 out of the 90 legislative seats in the state legislature.
Because they were so creatively drawn.
Exactly.
But, you know, I have to say, the fact that this came to the court in Wisconsin, you know, in a way it's like, I'm shocked, shocked, shocked. I mean, this has gone on for a long, long time. I mean, everybody knows this is the way it's done. Now, I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but this is the way it's done in most states. So why was it so, you know, shocking that it finally reached the Wisconsin court? Go ahead, Jennifer.
It was shocking because the Wisconsin court used math algorithms and geometry as evidence to show just how these districts can be drawn unfairly, and suggest that math and science can actually be used to align the districts, redraw the districts. And there's a professor at Tufts University right now. Her name is Moon Dutchin. And she is involved in a project by which mathematicians are getting together and actually training one another to be experts in how to testify in these gerrymandering cases regarding the math and science behind gerrymandering. Never before has the Supreme Court been able to draw a standard by which to judge partisan gerrymandering, whether it's constitutional or unconstitutional. But now, with these mathematical algorithms that are developing, there may be the opportunity for the court to actually develop a standard. That's why it's so interesting. And the three-court panel in Wisconsin, the federal district court panel, that actually found that the partisan gerrymandering was unconstitutional, used that specific evidence.
Interesting. So there have been standards, John, right, in the past to prove racial gerrymandering. That's established. Political gerrymandering has been a little bit more of a new frontier.
That's right.
Though it's been going on for a long, long time.
Right. If the finding is that the redrawing of districts is to disadvantage a racial minority, that is been clearly held to be unconstitutional. One of the problems is that political gerrymandering, partisan gerrymandering, often uses race as a tool for redrawing because certain racial groups tend to vote along certain predictable lines. In North Carolina, for example, African Americans vote for Democrats at a higher rate than people who are registered as Democrats do. So it's a really messy area of the law. Interestingly, the Supreme Court has agreed to review this Wisconsin decision.
That's the big one then.
That's
for
right.
The fall.
And I think Justice Kennedy is the wild card here. I expect that the more conservative members of the court are going to say that we've always done this. There's no standard by which we could hold this to be unconstitutional. Courts should stay out of this. I think the more liberal justices are going to be open to the idea that there are ways to say that's too much. And the big question is Justice Kennedy, because in the past, he has expressed an openness to taking a look at new standards as they emerge.
The case's name is Gill versus Whitford. That's going to be the case to watch.
Okay. And that'll be in the fall of 2017, where everybody's starting to think about how districts will be drawn and for the 2018 election.
That's right. And it could have huge ramifications because, you know, the 2020 election is coming up. I mean, and that, you know, after 2020, we're going to have a census again in 2020. So the results of the 2020 election are going to be very, very significant for purposes of redistricting as we move forward into the next decade.
Well, we've talked about a lot of cases this hour, but to both of you, Jennifer, you first, which ones are you really going to be working into your classrooms this fall?
Absolutely, Gill versus Whitford. And there's also, the name escapes me now, but we're coming up on another consideration of unions and whether dues and fees must be paid. It's back at the Supreme Court after a pass while there was no ninth justice. So that one's going to be pretty important, too.
That's right. Nine justices now, so they can get to work. Yes, go ahead, John.
For me, it's the issue is going to be the collision between claims of religious liberty and equal protection. The Supreme Court took a case called Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission yesterday, and it's going to review whether Colorado can force bakers, photographers, and others who have religious objections to participating in same-sex weddings, whether Colorado law can say you cannot say no.
All right. So you'll be keeping an eye on that one for us. Thank you both very much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.